Hey, it's Kyle Meredith, host of the Kyle Meredith With podcast, presented by WFPK at WFPK.org and the Consequence Podcast Network. It's a series that puts the spotlight on iconic musicians and actors, inviting them to drop by and talk about their latest projects, whether it's albums, TV shows, films, or beyond.
I'm going to say something I don't want to say. Here it goes. Without Spinal Tap, there is no Tenacious D.
Whoa. Man.
We get great stories and the biggest scoops from people like Garbage's Shirley Manson, the 1975's Matty Healy, Jack Black and Kyle Gass of Tenacious D, Maya Hawke, Kiefer Sutherland, and everyone in between. New episodes arrive every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, so it's a great way to keep up with your favorite artists and discover some new ones. You can find Kyle Meredith With on the Consequence Podcast Network or wherever you get your podcasts.
Borahe Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hello, Opus listener. This is Mijon Zulu, lead podcast producer at Consequence. In celebration of the 50th anniversary of hip-hop, we've opened up the Opus podcast archives to re-release seasons focused on some of history's most legendary rap albums. Next up, we revisit Cypress Hill's self-titled record, a landmark of West Coast rap that pioneered the weed rap movement. What's more, Cypress Hill's own Be Real, Sendog, and DJ Muggs all joined us for this journey through the album's legacy. When you're done with that, you can find all of our Hip Hop 50 content on Consequence, including loads of artist interviews, essays, and more coming out throughout the month. So be sure to check it all out at consequence.net. You can also snag some of our exclusive Hip Hop 50 merch at the Consequence shop at shop.consequence.net. And be sure to check back here every Wednesday and Friday for the next 2 weeks as we revisit Cypress Hill's debut record and continue our celebration of Hip Hop's 50th.
Despite what the man wants us to think, true hip-hop fans and true hard rock and metal fans have a lot in common. They both harbor a healthy distrust of authority. They both value an edge to their music, and they're both extremely protective of their respective genres to anyone perceived to be inauthentic. They're opposers in every scene, and they must be eradicated. Even though on paper hip-hop and metal should go together like chocolate and peanut butter, we've all seen attempts at this combo go terribly wrong in a number of different ways. Like chocolate and cheese. Now, no offense to the fine gentleman of Ween, it's a great album title, but if somebody hands you a chunk of provolone dipped in Godiva, you're going to have a bad Valentine's Day. Cypress Hill, though, got a lot of things right. DJ Muggs chose the exact right samples and manipulated them in the exact right ways. Sendog and Be Real wrote the exact right rhymes and delivered them in the exact right way. And somehow they appealed to hardcore fans of two hardcore styles of music in the exact right way. In this episode, we're talking about what made Cypress Hill so attractive to fans of all kinds of heavy music and put them head and shoulders above everyone else attempting the same crossover. For the Consequence Podcast Network and Sony Legacy, I'm Jill Hopkins, and this is The Opus.
Let's open up this pit.
In the fall of 1993, one of my most indelible memories still lives. I'll never forget walking through the hallway at my high school between a bank of lockers and a stairway, when a kid in Carl Kani jeans passed two dudes. One was wearing a Metallica shirt and one was wearing a Megadeth shirt. Kani just yells out, "Insane in the Membrane," and the high school Hetfield and Mustaine gave back a very guttural, "Insane in the Brain." It was peak early 90s. And it was great because in the early and mid 90s, hip hop and hard rock were arguably at their respective peaks. And because I went to a school where kids from all over Chicago went, as opposed to a neighborhood school, that meant we had a healthy hip-hop head student body, as my own neighborhood school would have, but with the added bonus of a long-haired metalhead population. The two factions were very friendly. I think the level of cultural live and let live was very high. And honestly, so were a lot of us. There also seemed to be an understanding that what was going on across the aisle was quality. So respect was paid. Bands and groups of all kinds were firing on all cylinders the year Cypress Hill made their debut. Here is Sendog.
I think that time, you know, in hip-hop, is referred to as the golden era.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think we should be referring to all of music as the golden era of that time, because Nirvana was around and Soundgarden, you know, those were all, you know, classic records. And like Garth Brooks was out there, you know, putting out a classic album as well. I don't know. I just think that at some point in time, in some year, a group of people are going to get together and do their thing and become one big collective. And I think it's just always meant to happen. It just, people just had to come together, form groups and whatnot and figure it out. It's kind of hard to explain, kind of, because we're all different genres. And how do we all come out in this one year? I don't know. It's a weird thing. I could just say that we were ready when that time came. We had been waiting for that time to come. And when it did, we were ready. We were on tour with, you know, all those bands except for Garth. You know, we were doing things with all those bands.
And the fans were ready for what they were laying down. Cypress Hill was appreciated by both sets of heavy music fans, and not just appreciated. They were loved. And by the fall of 1993, around the time when the Judgment Night soundtrack was released and rap rock was asserting itself as a legitimate thing, Cypress Hill had achieved maybe the first truly successful hip-hop to metal crossover. And they had an official metalhead seal of approval even before they'd released any music. And not just any metalhead.
There was a guy named Dave Lombardo that played drums for a band called Slayer.
Mm-hmm.
And his girlfriend lived a couple houses down from my mom's house. And he would come down there and peek his head out and see us making noise and hitting beats and rhyming. And he'd come down there and listen for a half an hour and, you know, get his little high on, whatever. And he would tell us, "Hey, you guys sound good, man, you know?" So that was kind of like an inspirational thing for us because, you know, Slayer was already dominating. So, you know, that was a big deal for us. It kind of made us feel like this guy's giving us a compliment. I'm sure he's not lying to us.
Good guy, that Dave Lombardo. I don't know if he knew at the time that, like him, the MCs in Cypress Hill were also Cuban, but it makes sense that he may have picked up on some references while listening in through his girlfriend's window. For a group to really cross over in the way that Cypress Hill does, a few things need to be true. Number one, the music must be both aggressive and easy to dance to. Number two, the lyrics must speak to both groups, when and if they're decipherable. Disenfranchisement, rage against man as well as machine, and a hearty dose of middle finger vibes are a great place to start. And number three, I hate to boil this down to aesthetics, but hey, you gotta sell t-shirts, right? The music was the main reason, of course, to why people started coming around to the Cypress Hill side, but visually, who among us who prefer the arts a little dark could resist? Joe Nicolo and Chris Schwartz of Cypress's label Roughhouse Records know how far marketing and imagery can get a group whose music is doing a lot of the heavy lifting, but needed a little something extra to push them over the hump. This debut album was a slow burn that was helped along by MTV and their album cover. A
lot of skulls and crossbones.
Yeah. I was going to say that, but I figured I'd let Joe test
it. It was dark. I mean, kids, those kids, they love that dark. You know, what was that? Ozzy. And it was, dark is a universal language at that age, and it just crossed over because originally the urban community did not embrace Cypress Hill, even a little bit. I mean, they fought it tooth and nail.
6 months. 6 months that we shipped the record, it sat in the mud for 6 months, like 32,000 copies, and we were tearing our hair out trying to figure out why. We knew how good the record was, and we knew that everybody who was exposed to it loved it, and it wasn't until like the B-side of the third single was in the Juice soundtrack, and then it just, mm-hmm. we went from 32,000 copies in 6 weeks to selling 50,000 copies a week.
The Killer Man song played over a minute and a half. I think it played like 97 seconds, maybe even longer. The Killer Man song played in the Juice movie. When you have something played that long, you know.
Tupac was chasing Omar Epps at the house party in the warehouse.
That was the flint that lit the fire.
Hollywood Steve Huey from AllMusic.com has his thoughts about what about the Cypress Hill formula worked.
They had very heavy metal artwork. That Cypress Hill logo looks like a metal band logo, and the cover of Black Sunday looks like a heavy metal album cover. If I remember right, I think the Cypress Hill album looks like a heavy metal album cover as well.
Mm-hmm.
You had these sets of signifiers that told heavy metal fans, hey, we're cool. You can be cool with us. Like, Welcome to our, let's all smoke a bowl together and have a good time and talk about violence, because that's also appealing to heavy metal fans.
And let's not discount something as simple as font choice and a cool looking logo when thinking about how to grab attention at the record store. Here's Sendog.
There's nothing that we did on that first record to make people think that we're like these metalheads or whatever. I think it's a hip hop record, but they caught on to something. Maybe the guitar riffs in Killer Man or something like that. Something brought them in. You know, along the same time, we had developed our first logo, and the band actually developed the logo. All three of us sat down one day, and my whole thing was like, I wanted to look like some heavy metal, you know, t-shirt, because in hip hop, you had the big letters, sometimes the faces on the shirts. And I'm like, I don't want any of us to be on the part of the logo. The logo should be this thing by itself, like, you know, like the Led Zeppelin and the angel falling from the sky and the wings spread out. Like, you know it, you see it, Led Zeppelin. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So everybody put their ideas together, and we came up with that logo. And I think that logo crossed the line from just a hip hop thing into like the rock and roll and the metal thing, because it was a fresh logo and people wanted to wear it. And then on the back of that shirt, it said the funky Cypress Hill shit. And if you wore that shirt back then, you were considered a little bit of a rebel outlaw, you know, kind of thing. So I think that all of that helped us like kind of cross over to, you know, other crowds that normally wouldn't have paid attention to us if we would have just came out with like any other logo. I think the logo really helped us move from genre to genre. And if you look at, you know, our Black Sunday album, it looks like a heavy metal record, you know. And that's what we were going for. You know, that's exactly what we were going for, because nobody in hip hop was doing that. And that way we were guaranteed that second look from that kid just flipping through albums and shit at the record store. What was that? That looked crazy. You know, and that was Cypress Hill right there.
I mentioned the soundtrack to the movie Judgment Night earlier in this episode, and it may be a generational thing to assume that everyone sees that album as a cultural touchstone that needs no explaining, but just in case. Judgment Night was a movie that starred Emilio Estevez, post-starring in the great soundtrack-having film Repo Man. It also starred Cuba Gooding Jr., Dennis Leary, Stephen Dorff, and Jeremy Piven, and it was about what happens when you make bad choices in worse neighborhoods. Yeah, that's boiling it down pretty good. The plot is whatever, but the soundtrack was a game changer. It was the first time an entire album was dedicated to this new partnership between hip-hop and alternative and heavy rock. Genres that were finally getting mainstream respect and representation were being blended together, and it worked. Helmet with House of Pain worked. Biohazard and Onyx worked, and it worked so well for Cypress Hill that they earned themselves two spots on the soundtrack, once with Sonic Youth and again with Pearl Jam. The group would go on to fully embrace, acknowledge, and poke a little fun in the hip-hop and hard rock ways of life years later with 2000's Rap Superstar and Rock Superstar. The boys understood where they sat in the scenes and were the right people to do the job of roasting both in a way that only a true friend can. The MCs of Cypress Hill have become not just true friends of hard rock, but active and deliberate participants in it. Chuck D of Public Enemy is a fan of artists who display that kind of range.
Sendog, years ago, I think he put together a band called SX10 that was just fire. And then he had his power band, I think it's Power Rule. He had a band as well as Prophets of Rage going out. He did his metal band and sounded fantastic. They all really sound fantastic. So that's their lane. That's their thing, because you know you got to ride those rhythms and those riffs hard, and they do it well.
And Prophets of Rage, the supergroup with Chuck D and DJ Lord from Public Enemy, Tom Morello, Brad Wilk, and Tim Comerford from Rage Against the Machine, and Be Real from Cypress Hill, embodies that same aggressive feel that their members' main projects have cultivated to great success. And in Chuck D's case, for well over 30 years. That supergroup's formation took a while. And it only really became cohesive, at least for Chuck, when he found out who else would be joining him behind the mic.
There was a thing where Tom Morello wanted to answer to what was happening and what was a growing force and sentiment in 2015. Where that country was leading to, the United States. And he didn't have Rage Against the Machine, but thought he can actually answer to the growing sense of fascism and confusion with a band statement. And he decided to put together a supergroup and reach out and touch everybody. And originally he wasn't, you know, he just was thinking about, okay, him, Tim, Tom, and maybe a voice that would lead them. I already had Public Enemy was on tour, and I was like, and nobody's going to step into Zach De La Rocha's shoes and be Rage Against the Machine. So Tom had been asking around, and, you know, it just took my wife at the time to be able to say in a conversation that he could do it, but it takes some convincing. Then my dad passed, and I was looking for new everything. But then I kind of went to a rehearsal or whatever one time, and not even a rehearsal. I went to a getting together, but I didn't have it on my, you know, on my radar. But it was something I wanted to explore. And then one day Tom said, well, how would you feel about Be Real being like another vocalist? And I was like, then it all started to make sense. I said, yes, that makes all the sense in the world. Because then I could be the second vocalist. He could be the first vocalist. It started to work in my head. I would bring DJ Lord along. And that's when the Prophets of Rage thing made, it only made sense if another vocalist could be with it to tackle some of these different songs. And that's when Tom said, he asked me, what do you think about Be Real? That to me was the beginning of Prophets of Rage. He's the only MC that would make sense to me, alongside me. I made my determination that I was going to be microphone 2 to his microphone 1. And that made us a powerful, powerful vocal presence to be able to tackle those Rage Against the Machines, the anthems hard, and to be able to take fired up Public Enemy songs, Cypress Hill songs. As crazy as that sounds, because those songs, those are amped up anthems as they are, but put a little rage to it and take it to a different place. You have to have a lot of vocal power, strength, fury, and nonstop. And those Rage Against the Machine songs, and even Zach knows this, because as Rage Against the Machine reforms, I say, well, Zach, the 50-year-old Zach has to jump in the 25-year-old Zach's skin. So you have to seriously test your body, your mind, your soul to take it on. Yes, those are your songs, but you got to go to them and take it on with that much more of a preparation, vigor, commitment than ever before. We were coming in and we were making also new songs too. So we had to figure out the alchemy and the design to attack those songs. You can't do those songs. You got to attack those songs.
I think Chuck really nails it here. Cypress Hill is able to appeal to both fans of hip-hop and hard rock because the attack is the thing. The approach is the thing. The edges and points are the thing. There's nothing curvy or soft about this music, even though it is made with love. And that's what fans of heavy music appreciate. That's what they love back. While I was talking to Chuck D, I asked him what he thought people should know about Cypress Hill that they might not know already. And he said,
a lot of times when people talk about Cypress Hill, they immediately go to the smoke. And I'm like, okay, that's the outer layer. They're like, the smoke in Cypress Hill is like Saturn's rings. That's just the rings. It ain't the planet. You know what I'm saying?
So for the fourth and final episode in this Cypress Hill season, we'll talk about the rings and the planet. The group's smoke that has definitely been fire, and the activism behind it that makes them a very interesting planet indeed. For the Consequence Podcast Network and Sony Legacy, I'm Jill Hopkins, and this has been The Opus. I'll see you next time, rockers. My shuttle, driving a huddle, pilot on auto. I'm not a role model, more like a psycho. A Bates type of psycho, cutting you like Michael. Halloween character or computer wizard. Hit you with the blizzard, cut your circuit with my scissors. Short circuit crosswire, you're in the crossfire. You get blasted, you dumbass bastard. See, you need the data, better say data. You're looking at the tribe and you're a hater. Coming from inside makes it come better. Or should I say rather...
Consequence Podcast Network.
Jorge Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska. And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 8. On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.